Welcome to the podcast. It's dedicated to making you a faster cyclist, the Ask a Cycling Coach podcast, presented by Trainer Road. I am Coach Jonathan Lee, and here with me, as always, is Coach Chad Timmerman.
Hey, everybody.
And our CEO, Nate Pearson.
Hello.
And today, we're going to answer more of your cycling questions. We've got a bunch of them to go through. You can submit those questions to us at support@trainerroad.com, and we will go through all the lists, or the big list of questions. We'll go through all of them and see which ones we can pick out that we feel will benefit the most people. We get a lot of questions every week, so if you don't answer yours, sorry. It's just the way it goes. But submit it again. Give it a shot, or make it more applicable, maybe. Who knows? We'll try our best. So you can find this podcast on iTunes. You can find it on Stitcher. You can find it on SoundCloud and wherever else you aggregate your podcasts. And please leave us reviews on those platforms. And I saw a number of you guys going on to SoundCloud, and you were leaving, you know, timestamp comments and questions and stuff like that. Good on you. I like that. And we'll keep up with that. So that type of community management of those SoundCloud files really does help a lot. So we appreciate it. We're going to kick things off with David. He has a question that ties in a lot like, or I guess I should say it ties in with another question we got, because we had somebody ask for more clarification about high inertia and low inertia on the trainer and how that's different and how it trains your body and everything else. So David says, hi, super podcast guys. It gets listened to at least twice each week, once when I'm hurting on the trainer, and then on the way to work to catch what I missed through the pain of the workout. I can't shout how great Trainer Road and the podcast are, as I don't want to put the competition onto using it. Joking, sort of. I have a question about, that's a good tactic, by the way. Maybe not, actually. Spread the word.
Don't do that, yeah.
Spread the word.
Just up your game.
A rising tide floats all ships. Remember this. So I have a question about gearing, which I hope Jonathan might be able to clear up for me, as he mentioned his gearing on the trainer a few times in the podcast, and I'm left a little confused. Hoped I could get more detail from him. I use a Wahoo kicker, and when in erg mode, I use the little ring in the front and the little ring on the cassette. Obviously crossing the chain, but it's an old bike. I do this because doing so gives me a much more reliable power reading between my kicker using Trainer Road and my stage's power meter. In doing so, the wattage reading is much more identical between the two. That's an interesting point, huh, guys? That he finds it in a different gear. It's more consistent. I tested this last night, actually, during my workout, and I have a stages, and I was using a kicker, and I definitely agree with you in the sense that in different gears, the power seems to spike a little less with the stages. So I think that's, in the end, probably how it's reporting slightly differently. I don't know. Nate, do you have any insight on that?
Yeah, I think it's because it's probably, and I'm guessing you're going to get into this, but he's going to have more constant pressure through his whole stroke. And mm-hmm. the stages, I'm guessing, instead of going like on a regular outside ride, it might go 240. And, you know, so stages can update, I think, up to every quarter second. Mm-hmm. You know, if you go 200, 250, 200, 250, or it comes out to be 225, 225, 225, 225. There's like a little bit more sporadic nature with higher inertia. That's what I'm guessing is happening, but I'm not really, really sure.
Yeah, if those quarter seconds fall at the same spot in your pedal stroke every time, right? Then that would be
yeah, you don't know. Smoother? It's probably not, actually, because it's I'm trying to think back of how stages does it. They have an accelerometer in it. It's if they do it every quarter second, it's not going to be the same time every time, because you're at 90 RPM, and that's going to be, mm-hmm. you know, if you're at 60 RPM, it would be the same. Right. I'm not really sure why it's going to be. I'm guessing what he's seeing is it's a smoother power output when he has low inertia. That's pretty much what he's saying. Mm-hmm. Although he's not putting out more or less power, it's just the stages is reporting less sporadic. I don't know if sporadically is the right word for it, but at a more smooth output.
Yeah, and I've also seen, just from some testing that some guys have done, the guys at Bike Radar and some other stuff, I've been privy to some data that they captured, and some electronic trainers, and this isn't like, for example, the Powerbeam Pro, the Kicker, the Tax Neo, but we're talking individual trainers here, like different trainers within the same model. Some of them they've shown from time to time, actually the way they measure power, it seems to have a greater differential at lower wattage or at higher wattage. It seems to vary, but that depends. And it's certainly not a every trainer case. And in this case, it doesn't seem like it's a big issue because you've been able to line it up.
Yeah. So, when he says more reliable power, I don't really know what he means by that. Mm-hmm. So I'm assuming that he means that it's not being, it's being like more smoothed, but maybe he's saying, that's a good point, Jonathan. He could be saying that the two power meters match up closer at lower speeds for the kicker. Mm-hmm. That's what you get when you get into smaller gears. But mm-hmm. I see what he's cross-chaining too. That's kind of the same speed as if he was in a different gear, not cross-chaining.
Yeah, that's like big ring and then up towards the top of the cassette, maybe not at the very top, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so... So he moves on. He says, I use a Wahoo kicker, and when in NERG mode, I use the... Oh, forgive me. If I use the big ring at the front and little ring on the cassette, the readings between the two are often 15 to 25 watts apart, and I end up continually adjusting the percentage scale to accommodate
it. We should have read ahead. So what he's talking about now, this is the slope of a power meter. So what he's saying is, if you're in a bigger gear on the kicker, that's going to be cause the flywheel of the kicker to spin more quickly. And he's saying at those higher speeds, they don't match up with his stages. And now, one thing you can do is download the Wahoo Utility app, and it's on iOS, and update the firmware of your kicker. That might fix that problem. If that doesn't fix your problem, I would suggest using PowerMatch and turning that on. And what we'll do is we'll read the kind of the average of your power meter if you have both those plugged in or both of those paired to Trainer Road, and we'll constantly nudge your kicker into it, adjust the value of it so that it matches your power meter. So basically what that does is most people do see a difference between the kicker or any electronic trainer and the power meter. And what this does is it uses your power meter to kind of drive your electronic trainer. That's what Power Match does.
Yeah. And I just actually used that last night. I know Chad uses it. Nate uses it. I use it. It's a really handy tool if you happen to have a power meter and an electronic trainer. There's just no more guesswork, no more running math to find out a differential at the end of your workout. So. Yeah,
exactly. It's the only way I'll train these days.
Yeah. Now, he says he ends up continually adjusting the percentage scale to accommodate it. I want to rely on the stages for the watts for the obvious reason of consistency inside and outside. I don't know about adjusting the percentage scale being a great idea. I think that once you use Power Match, you'll find a much better solution there. So you say, I know I can change the settings on the Trainer Road with my power meter, but I prefer to use the kicker. Hopefully that answers that for you with Power Match. It says, Jonathan has mentioned in the past that he uses a certain gear ratio on the kicker as it works better. Could he explain that in more detail, please? He also said in one of the podcasts that when he went out on the road, having used a certain ratio, it had a negative impact on his race. Hope that all makes sense and you can spare a couple minutes to clear the confusion. It's probably just me that is confused.
So yeah, this is two different things. There's one is he's trying to match up two power meters, right? The kicker and the stages. And at different speeds of the kicker, he's getting different power. And what that tells you, to get a little technical, is that the slope of each power meter isn't the same. So the slope means, imagine you're on a graph, some graph paper, and you draw a line from, you know, the XY coordinate of zero, and you draw it up and to the right. Well, the two trainers, those lines don't have the same slope. So as you get to higher wattages, they're diverging more. And you can do spin downs. Usually with a power meter, there's two different ways to calibrate. There's usually when you, like on your Garmin, when you do calibrate or in Trainer Road calibrate, what you're really doing a zero offset, which is like on a scale, if you touch a little button and it says like, okay, we're going to see what I weigh right now and just say that's the zero starting point.
That's a huge misconception, by the way. I see a lot of people like thinking that they're actually calibrating their power meter on their Garmin or using Trainer Road or anything else like that. And you're just establishing a zero offset.
To really change the slope. So most power meters will have the slope correct, but to really change the slope, you have to, on most power meters, you hang a weight, a known weight, and not just like, oh, I have this 10-pound dumbbell. Like we have a 25 kilogram weight at Trainer Road that we hang from the pedal, and it's certified to be within 2 grams of 25 kilograms. And that's the only way to really get the slope right. And then there's this other thing with power meters is that usually they'll have built in a temperature offset or temperature compensation. So as the temperature changes, that then fixes it. That's what the latest kicker firmware update it's been out for a few months now, but that takes into account temperature offset while you ride. And I think the Stages does have that built in already. I think Power 2 Max didn't originally have it, and then they put it in later, and they have it now. Don't hold me to that. It's better to Google that than to... there's so many power meters, I get them kind of confused.
One thing along those lines, too, with the Stages, and you do the zero offset, I've seen people just not pedal, and I've seen people pedaling and hit calibrate on
Garmin.
Oh,
yeah, don't do that.
That's really bad. I've seen people not pedaling and coasting and doing that. That's also not a great idea. The best idea is for you to fully unclip from your pedals so you're not applying any type of flex to that crank arm. Because even if you're clipped in, you may very well be applying some force and not realize it. And then you have to have the crank arm down to 6 o'clock, that power meter side, so it's the non-drive side.
And you said Stages says that, but like with the Quark, you can just pedal backwards 5 times, and that will zero it too. Because it's looking for power, like positive force going through. And if you go back 5 times, that's enough to zero it. So you can actually do it during a race. And I've done that on like a downhill. I'll backpedal 5 times.
And supposedly the Power 2 Max does it every time there's, I think, a 3-second break in pedaling. So it does it automatically.
Pretty cool. Yeah, so that's a tip for all of you guys. If you see people backpedaling when they're in the draft in a crit or something like that, that's probably why. Or they're just trying to flush their legs. So
let's talk now about the inertia and that part, because it's a separate question.
I found a good article on this because I don't think I did a great job of describing this last time. It's always tough to describe something you're feeling on the bike like that, but Cycling Tips, they have an article that is, it says, climbing versus time trialing, the same effort, different power output. And Wade Wallace, our friend there, wrote it up. So kudos on this one, Wade.
What's really interesting, and they should add it to this title, is same effort, different power output, but it's also the same cadence. So same effort, same cadence, different power output.
Yeah, exactly. So a lot of variables are the same. So kudos on this article. There's one paragraph that I really feel like nails at home, but I recommend you guys give it a read. It's got some really interesting stuff. So it says, when you're pedaling up a climb with low kinetic energy, so when we're talking about kinetic energy, that's all the energy stored in your body, your bike, everything that you're moving down the road, right? There's energy when you're moving that down the road. So it says, when you're pedaling up a climb, low kinetic energy, traveling slowly, and gravity's holding you back, your legs impart force on the pedals for a much longer duration throughout the stroke, even though your cadence might be the same as when time trialing. And this is just comparing between a time trialist and a climber throughout this whole article. And that's really what it ends up being, is you end up needing to recruit those muscle recruitment patterns. They fire differently when you're applying that force throughout the whole pedal stroke, right, Chad? Versus if it's much tougher to do that, to apply equal force throughout the pedal stroke when you're moving really quickly.
That's exactly it. So if you think about kinetic energy as when you're on a flat road and you're, spinning along at 30 miles or let's say 20 miles an hour and you stop pedaling, you'll keep on sailing along at 20 and then 19 and then 18. But if you do that same thing on a climb, you're going 20 miles an hour and you take pressure off the pedals for even just a couple seconds, you'll plummet, 15, 10, 8. So there's far less kinetic energy. So in order to keep that same speed, you have to apply more muscle force through more of the pedal stroke than you would if you had a bunch of kinetic energy like you would on a flat road.
I've got a great analogy. Okay, so hopefully it's probably for our U.S. people, and I'll describe it for other people who are outside the U.S., but The Price is Right. Okay, there's this giant wheel that people have to spin. So they do, there's this giant wheel and there's a ticker that goes around, and where the wheel lands, you get a prize. And you see people start that wheel and they jump up, and it's really hard to start that wheel. So you can imagine too, is like a giant stone flywheel if you don't know what The Price is Right is. Now imagine if you had to move that wheel around at a pretty slow speed. Like you would have to kind of like crank it all the way through and do that. But imagine, too, those guys who like rip it and it starts to get going, then it has a lot of inertia, right? It went spinning. It's a heavy wheel, flywheel. It's already spinning. And now you just have to keep it going. You kind of just like use one hand and you kind of just push it right down in one spot. And that's enough to go through the whole pedal stroke. So to kind of through the whole spin. So to bring that back to what Chad said, normally riders, the strongest part is that downstroke. And that's enough to get you going. But if you were at a lower inertia and you really had to move that like giant stone flywheel, The Price is Right wheel, you kind of have to put power through the whole thing to get it going. Mm-hmm. Okay, that could have confused a lot of people. People are like, what? I'm on The Price is Right?
For anybody that's seen The Price is Right, hopefully they can visualize that.
Oh, you can Google it too.
Yes, yeah, I'm sure you can. It's all over. And one thing to remember, you may be thinking, well, you guys aren't moving on a trainer, so all of this is null and void. And that would be correct if it weren't for flywheels on the trainers. So the kicker has an extremely, I think it's 45 pounds, right? Their flywheel. It's heavy.
It's heavy.
I don't know.
Yeah, it's heavy. Flywheel. And the certain trainers, like I know the Rode machine, for example, you can get an extra heavy flywheel for it. Their intent with those flywheels is to emulate the kinetic energy that you would have when traveling at a certain speed. That's their goal, right? So yeah. That's emulating the kinetic energy. So when we're talking about spinning in a really, really low gear, so one where you're, you know, not going quickly, something you'd be using going up a hill, it's spinning that flywheel slowly to emulate that lack of kinetic energy, relative lack of kinetic energy that you would have.
And the kicker too doesn't even replicate outside riding. I want to say someone on the Slow Twitch forum did the math, and I think it was like half of what you would get outside on like a regular flat road. The best trainer that I've seen that replicates that is actually the Le Mans Revolution, which is a wind trainer. That thing though is extremely loud and it's not electronic. For electronic trainers, the kicker is by far the best. And the way to replicate outside inertia is you have two choices. You can either have a heavier flywheel or you can spin it more quickly. So that's where if you're in a bigger gear and you're spinning that wheel, if you're in a bigger gear, you're going to spin that flywheel faster. That's going to replicate more of a flat road, high inertia riding. And then when you get down into a lower gear, that flywheel, although it's still the same weight, it's going to spin more slowly. And that's then going to replicate slower riding, or not slower riding, but lower inertia riding. Like how Jonathan says, if he's going up a 10% grade on a mountain bike, going, I don't know, 4 or 5 miles per hour?
Yep. Yeah. 5, 6. Yeah.
Yeah. That's. So Jonathan's like 7, 8. I'm pretty fast.
9, 10.
it's a lower inertia thing. And that's what he wants to replicate in his training. But if you're a road racer, you're barely ever going to get, I mean, that type of 99% right. of your racing is probably going to be at that higher inertia racing. If you're a triathlete, almost all of it's going to be.
Yeah, you see that in the Giro and like the Mortirolo and climbs like that, where it's just so steep. Every time their leg goes down, one leg goes down to like 5 o'clock, they stop. You know, that's like super low inertia. But if you train on the kicker, you'll see in the gear that you plan to race in, you should be training for something that's similar. So that's a good rule of thumb there. Hopefully that explains it all, David. Matt, he says, can you go into some detail on how to adjust or balance your training if you need to lose lots of weight? Not just getting back to race weight, but like 20 kilograms.
Yeah, Matt, I think we've discussed this topic a lot. The difference here, if you're trying to lose a lot of weight, is it's going to be more about your dietary intake than exercise. It's going to make the greater impact. That's not really within the realm of trainer road. So the training itself is probably, you know, like I said, we've covered this before. I don't know that we're going to be able to add too much to it. But to advise you to look more closely at your diet, and basically you're just looking for a daily deficit, right? You know, you want to burn more calories than you take in, but the quality of what you're eating makes a huge impact on that. So, you know, maybe, you know, you burn for whatever, you know, you've done your basal rate and you know, you're exercising an additional 500 calories on top of that. So, you know, you burn, let's say 2,500 calories a day. Doesn't mean you can eat 2,000 calories worth of Twinkies and expect to lose weight just because you're coming in at a deficit.
No, so, you will.
Well, you'll still lose weight.
You will.
Your performance, however, is going to suffer.
You won't feel good.
And a lot of other things are going to suffer with it. Yeah. So yes, technically, you will lose weight, but that's obviously not the way you want to go about it. And that also cultivates a metabolic response that is absolutely not desirable. Not in terms of general health, certainly not in terms of performance.
Okay, as the fat guy, I'm not fat. Like I got to show get you guys pictures of myself. I know as a fat guy on the podcast with two skinny minis. This is how I'm doing it right now, and we can talk a little about our weight loss. So one thing, Matt, there's things to think about while you're training. One, the stronger you get, the more calories you're going to burn per workout. Two, you need to, if you're serious about losing 20 kilograms, that's a lot of weight. I would get MyFitnessPal, which is an iOS app. It's free, and we have no association with them, and log all the calories that you eat per day. If you really want to do this right and do it quickly and lose weight and have it be as enjoyable as possible, I would totally track all the calories that you eat, mm-hmm. do all the train road workouts, put that into the app and say, this is how many calories I burned, and then do a deficit of, you've got some weight to lose. So you could probably do a 300 or maybe even a 400 calorie deficit a day and be just fine. Still do your workouts. That's going to train you and be good. I mean, again, you're tracking your calories. So gaining fitness is kind of awesome at the same time, because the stronger you get, the more you'll lose. But then actually too, you're losing all this weight. And I think at that much, if you have that much weight to lose, 20 kilograms, you're going to actually, which is 44 pounds for people that in the US, you will still raise your FTP while losing that weight. You won't be like Jonathan, where he's so skinny that, I almost said small, skinny, that
I'm small too.
As you lose weight, he has to worry about his FTP might go down. But so when you watch your FTP go up, really though, look at your watt to kilogram, so your FTP to weight ratio, as that is going to go up much, much faster. So, and that's really how fast you're going to race, not just pure FTP. So track your calories, use MyFitnessPal, still work out. I would do like a low volume plan for you. And once you figure out like a sweet spot base, low volume, once you figure out that, yes, I can take this amount of stress, then try to go up to mid volume. But it's a jump, 5 to 6 times a week. It's the fork put downs. That's what you have to do.
Yeah, and Matt, even a preliminary step, if you don't want to go as far as counting calories, because I know that turns off a lot of people as soon as they hear they got to track everything and weigh things and measure stuff, they maybe don't commit to it. Just jot down everything you eat. Just become aware of everything you're putting into your mouth over the course of a day. You'd probably be surprised. There'd be a lot of filler, a lot of stuff that you maybe don't even realize you're eating. Certainly, a lot of stuff you don't need.
And just to clarify, that comes from. That's not as if Chad's saying that you're the one that would be surprised. We're all surprised. Like all of us.
Every time I do never, it.
Yeah, exactly. Every time we do that. And I keep track right now. I'm working with Trevor DeRuze. He's he's our community manager, so you'll see him on forums. But he's also a nutrition major and a pro mountain biker. He's like over 5 watts per kilogram when he isn't training, guys. It's absurd. He weighs like 128 pounds or something and has like a plus 300 FTP. So he and I are working on some stuff right now, and I'm counting every calorie and taking note of everything that I eat, and I'm logging it all because I really don't want to lose this weight loss thing against you guys. I just want to be faster, but,
I'm going to go throw up. I'll be right back.
And, the huge advantage we have as cyclists is the fact that we have a power meter, so we can objectively define caloric burn with our workouts. And that actually helps us quite a lot. If we measure our weight and if we measure body fat and other stuff like that, those Tanita scales are a good way for you to do that. Or at least so we found.
Yeah, we think so far.
But if you measure that stuff and then you're measuring your caloric intake and then you're measuring your burn with the power meter, it's pretty darn easy to find your resting metabolic rate, because you can remove all those other variables and it's a simple equation. So that's a huge leg up that you have as a cyclist in this weight loss game, is you can be more objective about different parts of that equation, of the intake output equation.
So here's what I'm doing right now, because I'm not actually tracking my calories, because we'll see. It's going to be really cool to go back and do our next DEXA scan, look at our body fat, and I'll see like, oh, Nate, you lost all muscle and 5 pounds of muscle and 1 pound of fat. Then I probably am going to change how I am doing this, but this is how I'm doing it right now, and take it with what it is, because we don't have definitive answer if this is the right way. I'm doing, I wake up and I have a protein shake, and that's it. I do a trainer road workout kind of around lunchtime, 6 days a week. And then I eat like a pretty small, reasonable lunch with vegetables, carbohydrates, and meat, and probably about twice the amount of meat compared to vegetables and carbohydrates. Have a reasonable dinner. And then if I'm hungry after that, I'll have Quest Nutrition protein bar, or I'll have a protein shake. And I try to go to bed hungry. And for me, going to bed hungry is like a huge, huge thing. Yesterday, I was at, I'm down in California right now at one of our offices, and I went to In-N-Out for dinner, and usually I would get a double with fries and like an iced tea or something. So I got just the hamburger, and I think just the double with no cheese was like 480 calories. If you add cheese, each slice of cheese is 90 calories. So that's 180 calories for cheese on a In-N-Out is a hamburger place that's famous in the West Coast of the U.S. So that two slices of cheese, that's almost like your daily deficit, you know, that you need those 200 calories. It's like crazy. Yeah. So anyways, that's what I'm just going to bed eating reasonable and going to bed hungry and doing workouts. Like, it doesn't sound crazy, right? Like,
Nate, you should keep eating In-N-Out before we do the next one, because that'll just really help our cause. That stuff is so salty, you'll retain water like a balloon.
That's actually, so if I retain water, I will have a lower percentage body fat because the water inside of me will have me weigh more, but my fat will, that's a way you can trick these tests, is if you want to, I shouldn't tell you guys this, but Chad actually drank coffee before his test last time, and all that coffee turned into non-fat mass, so his body fat was a little bit less.
I see.
Next time we have
two shots of espresso. I don't think it made that big a difference. Okay.
It wasn't a pot.
It was at least 8%.
All right, let's move on to Dave's question. Dave says, just a quick thank you for your podcast. I really do love listening to it every week. It's insightful and really helpful. Thank you all. Enough of the buttering up. We aren't sufficiently buttered up, Dave, but we'll still read your question.
Keep going.
More. I have a question for the podcast, if I may, please. You've talked a lot recently about raising your FTP by pushing up your power at VO2 max and the types of workouts that can be used to help with this. You've also mentioned that FTP typically falls between 78 to 85% of your power at VO2 max. Your power, am I saying that right, Chad? Yeah, perfect. So, and power at VO2 max is about 120% of your FTP. So, testing your FTP seems a well-defined protocol with either 20 minutes or 8 minutes. 8 minute test deriving the 0.95 or 0.92% FTP figure. So he's just referring to how we calculate FTP there with the two different tests. But he says, if I want to know what percentage my current power at VO2 max is in relation to my FTP, what is the standard defined testing protocol for power at VO2 max? 3 minutes, 4 minutes, 5 minutes, et cetera?
Dave, typically when people assess power at VO2 max or try to measure VO2 max, they do it with what's called a ramp test, which is an incremental exercise test where they start you at a very low wattage, and then at regular time durations or time intervals, they bump you up a little bit, and then they continue to bump you up until you reach a point of basically exhaustion. And then the whole time they're measuring gas exchange. It's a very technical and scientific process. You have to go to a lab to do it. So that's one way you can do it. Another way is we have if you're familiar with our teams, the team aspect of Trainer Road, there's a group. It's a public group and anybody can join it. It's called the PPO group. And there's some ramp protocols on there. The thing with the ramp protocols is they're all what they call protocol dependent, in that, you know, some people make the steps 30 watts, some people make them 40 watts, some people make them 30 seconds, some people make them 3 minutes. So whichever one you land on, if you decide to do the ramp method, you have to stick with that protocol from test to test. To simplify things quite a bit, you can just do a 5 minute all out effort, and it may not exactly measure your VO2 max, or more accurately your VO2 peak. VO2 max is actually a really hard thing to achieve. It's argued that you can achieve it at all, but that aside, to get a measure of what might be your power at VO2 max, just do a solid 5 minute effort. You know, make sure, just like an FTP test, you're fully refreshed, ready to do it and motivated. You know, maybe you have the perfect couple of songs and just drill
warmed
it
up.
And thoroughly warmed up, and then just drill it for 5 minutes. And even if you don't get your exact power at VO2 max, you'll have a really good, you know, close approximation of it. And then when 4, 5, 6 weeks of training rolls by, you do that exact same protocol, that same 5 minute effort with the same warm up, maybe even the same, as few variables as possible, do the same thing again, and you can measure whether or not your power at VO2 max has risen. So the 5 minute effort is a really simple way to go about it.
It hurts too. Another workout before, like pre-power meter days, and for those listeners who don't have power meters outside, Chad, tell me if this is good or not. So you do a thorough warm-up, find a hill that's decently long, but not too long, and you're going to do five intervals, pretty much 3 minutes all out with 5 minutes rest in between. And that's going to mimic kind of VO2 max. And when I say all out, I don't want you to like sprint off the, you know, pace that evenly through it. But at the end of those 3 minutes, you should be really hurting. Go back down the hill. And so five intervals with 5 minutes rest in between, that's one workout. Next time you go do it, you should go a little bit higher up or farther up the hill. And that's like a poor man's F or VO2 max workout when you don't have a race or something like that.
Yeah, test, so to speak.
Yeah, that could be pretty close to VO2 max. I think it'd have more of an anaerobic contribution than you'd want for a VO2 max assessment because the efforts are kind of short. But if you're doing five of them and you could kind of compare how each one of them stacked up, it's as effective as anything. I mean, you just want to see improvement, right? In this case, you'd be looking at improvement in 3-minute power, and the difference in VO2 uptake between a 3-minute power and a 5-minute power is measurable. So I would stick with 5-minute efforts, but you could do Nate's exact protocol and just use 5-minute efforts for that.
Ooh, that would be tough. If you did have a power meter with my with what I was saying, I would just pace at 120% FTP.
Yeah, and also we should add with the, it's not the 8-minute format, but the 20-minute FTP protocol, there is a 5-minute effort at the beginning of it. And that's largely dedicated to the warm-up or to warming you very thoroughly. But if you really get after that, that can be serve as a good measure of your power at VO2 max. And that is actually why it's included, because you have an opportunity to see roughly what's my power at VO2 max. Then you follow it up and find out what's your power at FTP. And then in one simple test, not easy by any stretch of the imagination, but simple, you've got an effective measure of both of them that you can compare every time you do your FTP test if you're using the 20-minute format.
Hopefully it gives you all the answers you need there, Dave. I don't have anything to chip in. Nate's covered. I was going to give it the poor man's test, but Nate gave that great. So, Amy, hi guys. I'm listening to your podcast every week now as I ride indoors on the trainer. I find the information really entertaining, valuable, and helpful. Today, I listened to the episode where you had DEXA scans. Fascinating, really, really good thoughts. But something popped into my head and also that also comes up in my head when you talk power numbers and power to weight ratios. I'm a girl, so what if any adjustments or differences should I be making from what I hear from you guys to how I apply these concepts to me? So let's first talk about the DEXA scans, and then we'll talk about power. Chad?
No, fire away.
I've only heard this, and I have no backing to back it up. I've read it everywhere, but I've never actually seen it in a journal or anything else. But it's correct, right? That women store more body fat. And so it's regular to see a greater percentage of body fat. It should be expected that way. As soon as I talked about the DEXA scan with my wife, she gave me a very stern look. So I don't think I'm ever going to get to carry out that experiment out of our home.
Yeah, it would have been fun to include one of the women in our office, but I don't think any of them were jumping at that opportunity.
My wife will do it.
Now, she'd humiliate us, though.
She's extremely low body fat.
I'll
have her do it. I don't know. She actually probably won't want it on the podcast either, though. Unless she beats Jonathan.
certain athletes that have, professional female athletes.
Liz Lyles.
Liz. I'm going to see if she is, first of all, if she has that data and if she's comfortable with sharing it. And then Amy, I'll get in touch with you and that will be a good, and then I'll try to get Trevor's body fat because Liz is even more lean than Trevor, but Trevor is like almost transparent. And Liz is just, she's top 10 female Ironman athlete in the world. So that'll be body kind of a comparison. So
with body fat with men and women, if you're at the, let's say we have two, a man and woman next to each other and they look like they have the same body fat, the woman will report at a higher body fat than the man. That's just what
it's
it
visceral,
is.
Visceral,
isn't it? Consistently, yeah.
So in generally.
And breast tissue.
The women are. We're going to have more body fat, but all of the, so you're going to have more body fat in general too. You're not going to be able to get your FTP up as high as a man. Not meaning that you can't, you take a woman and a man, a woman can definitely kick the booty out of any man, but in general at the highest levels in the world where, the highest level cyclist who's clean and the highest level, in everything, in all the Olympics and stuff, there'll be a constant percentage. I'm not really sure what that percentage, I forget what that percentage is, but at the top levels, when you take doping out of it, there's a difference between the performance and it's kind of the same.
It's about 10% at the high level, about 10%. So guys top out, 6.2, women top out like 5.5, 5.6 in the elite world-class level.
And that's watts per kilogram, Amy. That's what we're saying there.
And the concepts we're talking about are the same with men and women. It's really, be consistent. How much stress can your body take? Take that, follow your weight, do the correct kind of stress at the same time of year, that doesn't change. It's like, oh, you're a woman, so you need to do like these extra anaerobic workouts because you're going to have less muscle or something like that. That it's the same. Is that right, Chad?
Yeah, I agree. There's not much that women have to do differently from men. Just keep in mind that they're going to have higher body fat percentages, lower lean mass composition, just certain things. Guys carry more muscle, women carry more fat. It's unfair. It's just the truth.
And so, Chad, and that's also, they may, and we're not saying, so if you have a female athlete that looks extremely lean, she may report, and you have a male athlete, which this is a very, very hypothetical situation, but you have a female and a male athlete, they both look equally lean, the female would report higher. It's not that they necessarily store that fat. Where do they store that fat, Chad? Because it's different, right? Is that the whole concept there?
Yeah, I can't say for sure if it's more intramuscular or visceral or, I mean, obviously breast tissue counts for something. That's always going to, you know, and different women, different sizes are going to have greater impacts. But I honestly don't know for sure.
I'll do some research, Amy, and I'll see if I can get some info from some athletes for you. And so that can give you a point of reference. If they're okay with sharing that on the podcast, I'll share that out. But otherwise, look for me to contact you directly about that. So. Alistair, hi guys, massive fan of Trainer Road, and it's already made a massive difference to my riding, having used it for the first time this winter. I'm currently in week 5 of your high volume sustained power build training plan, and have just done the 20-minute FTP test as prescribed. Previous to this build plan, I completed your sweet spot based high volume plan, and found my FTP value to increase from 260 on day 1 to 288 after week 6, then to my current value of 311. Nice job. That's solid. 311 at the start of the build plan. Now in week 5, this is the first time my FTP has not changed, having seen the improvements mentioned above. Should I be worried about this? Is this normal during a sustained power build plan? I've noticed more of the rides are focused around longer sweet spot rides to improve muscle endurance, and I can feel it. Then the greater, and he's comparing that to the greater than 100% FTP intervals that were done before in the towards the end of the sweet spot base plan. If I wanted to focus primarily on improving my FTP, should I change build plans or just be patient and complete this block to see where I'm at? And then he says, maybe I should have been more rested before doing the last FTP test. Would it be worth redoing the test again to see if I fare better after a more restful weekend? Looking forward to hearing from you. Thanks, Alistair.
Yeah, Alistair, the first thing that springs to mind is just that you were just a little tired and you had an off day. It happened to be on an assessment day. So I wouldn't let it discourage you, and I wouldn't let it convince you that your FTP hasn't improved. If the workouts over the course of, you know, you said you're in the 5th week, if you're continually getting through the workouts, they're progressing in such a way that your fitness has to be on the rise. If, you know, you struggle with the first week and then you get through the second week and you manage to get through the third week, there's improvement all the while. So if you're completing these tougher workouts, your fitness is on the rise. Whether or not that manifests in the form of an FTP improvement may not always be the case. Sometimes, in the case of this, we're trying to improve your sustained power duration as much, maybe more so than we're concerned with FTP improvements. So maybe FTP doesn't go up, but now you're capable of riding at longer and longer stretches of FTP. And just because we call it hour power sometimes, there are very few athletes who can go out and hold their FTP for a solid hour. And with the sustained power build, that's one of the large emphases. We're trying to get you to get to a point where you can ride at or close to FTP for longer and longer durations. And we're trying to enhance that muscular endurance. So there probably is still an improvement in FTP, but it might not be as substantial as the one you've seen coming into this.
So what do you think you should do then? Just continue on or?
Yeah, I think you should finish out this. If he wants to assess again, he can. But, you know, like I said, the workouts progress. So you know how hard the workouts are. You're doing similar stuff. So if you're getting through a workout and it's just not as challenging as it was, you know, you probably did see that FTP improvement. Go ahead and nudge the workout intensity up a little bit. But you're close enough to the end of this routine. I think you're 5 weeks. So you got a couple more weeks and then a rest week before you dive into something else. I think at this point, there's no reason to change midstream.
And I'd like to see his weight too. And another point is, you went to 260 to 288 to 311. That's going to stop someday, right?
Yeah,
or else you're going to win the Tour de France.
Impressive jumps.
So that's sad, but if you lost any weight during this time, because that would then you still got more fit, but you're not going to do a 20 to 30 watt jump every 3 weeks. They're going to start going smaller. And then as you get to a really high level, you're like 5 watts. Yes, 5 watts. Like It's and mm-hmm. that's pretty awesome, right, guys?
Yeah. So you went from 260 to 288, which is about a 30 watt jump. Then from 290 ish to 311, which is about a 20 watt jump. So that's kind of what you're going to expect to see. So now the next one may be like a 311 to a 320 sort of jump, but they're going to get harder fought and smaller and smaller.
Yeah, big numbers are always sexy, Alistair, and they always get the attention. But to be honest, the person that can sustain a higher percentage of that number, mm-hmm. in many cases, that's the guy that's going to win on race day. What you've done is you've raised the tide, but now you're reinforcing everything around there, and it's just going to be able to maintain it much easier. You are getting faster. Your FTP isn't the only indication of getting faster, right? That's a key indication, but increasing your sustainable power is a huge, huge key. So
yeah, and then Alistair, you're probably reaching that point where your FTP is going to top out relative to its potential capacity. So, or to put it another way, now it's time to shift your focus and start targeting your VO2 max. So now your FTP improvements are going to become, you know, like I said, really hard fought. So now you basically need to increase your capacity a bit so that you can exploit more of that newly increased capacity. And that's you know, time for the harder, shorter stuff like VO2 max work.
And you didn't mention what specialty plan's coming up next, Alistair, for you, since you're working through the base build and specialty, but hopefully that advice gives you all the tools you need there. And once you get into the specialty plan, you're just going to be doing more fine tuning so you can really utilize all that work that you've done. So you can look forward to that. James, hey guys, I'm new to cycling and have found your podcast to be really helpful while I get my bearings in this sport. This isn't a training related question, but what's the difference between club fit jerseys and normal jerseys, and which do each of you prefer?
This is for Jonathan.
Go first?
All yours.
I'm kind of a nerd on this type of stuff.
You are.
I think it's, yeah, I don't know what my, I'm way too obsessed with appearances, guys. So
talk about your turquoise socks you're trying to find.
Please don't.
We don't have to go into this turquoise socks quest, but okay, talk about the club fit versus jersey fit.
Yeah, yeah. So I think it's weird because I think this actually is changing. It used to be like club fit jerseys was like the crappy event jersey that you got that you were like, okay, I got this jersey from this race, but I would never wear such a thing. You know, and it's ugly and it's fitting and it's baggy and it's kind of loose. But that seems to be changing. So traditionally, like club fit, there was club fit, and then I guess you say normal, but like race fit. But club fit jerseys were like relaxed, and race fit was tight. And generally what that meant was that the hem was shorter in the waist. They also were much tighter around your body. But then they also have a lot of jerseys. Race fit jerseys are designed not for like a mannequin standing up, but for a person in a position on a bike. So then there are no wrinkles when you're in that position. And it makes you faster. Hopefully you didn't need an extra piece of lettuce because that would probably make you slower than that, but you never know. So that was like the whole goal with that. And club jerseys just kind of got left to the wayside. But I just saw Rafa, for example, they have these new, it's called Core, and they have their new jerseys out. And it's like high-end stuff. It's just a different fit. It's more relaxed. It's a relaxed fit, but it's like still high-end stuff. It's not bad materials. And I know like with Quare and Jackru, those brands that we've mentioned before. Quare has like gold, silver, and bronze is more relaxed, and gold is full race, and Jackru has a whole variety to pick from too. So I think that you can't go wrong these days with which one fits. If you're a husky guy, you might like a club fit a little more. If you're more of a person if you're a trim person, then a race fit is going to be there. But race jerseys reveal everything. I don't know which one you guys prefer, but they reveal all imperfections.
I like race fit in general just because it fits a little tighter, and I don't like whenever I see my jersey flapping in the wind, I'm like, oh, those are watts going away. I don't want any watts going away. But just, you know, I took that year off and I gained some weight and I put on the race fit jersey again, and I was like, whoa, you can see like I am gained a little bit of weight. Like in that case, it would be probably more comfortable to wear club fit. So actually in my closet, so I have a mix. I have some club fit and I have some race fit, and some days I wear the club fit because I just want, it's just like, you know, on the weekends you might wear like a baggier t-shirt because that's really comfortable and like sweatpants, but you don't look as good. And then during the week you might wear your skinny jeans. We can't fit in skinny jeans. We have huge legs, but you know, in like a tighter or more fitting collared shirt or something. It's really comfort and then speed. So I want speed while I'm racing and then comfort kind of. But you know, you want to look good too, though. So,
Chad, you have broad shoulders for a cyclist. Like, you have the upper body of a fit person, like an overall fit person. You're not this diminutive centaur that are most cyclists.
Definitely not.
Yeah,
wavy.
Exactly. Yeah. So, what do you prefer? I mean,
I still like the race fit ones.
Some race jerseys.
Yeah, I still like race fit just because, you know, what Nate said, it's a balance between comfort and speed, and I'll take speed over that any day. But I got to say, you know, if I'm carrying a little extra weight, they are revealing, first off, and discouraging and motivating both at the same time. And then it's kind of hard to find exactly the right fit. It's going to be tight somewhere, and it's actually tight everywhere, but it's going to be like overly tight in the case of my shoulders or something. But it's nothing that restricts my breathing or is really even on my mind past actually putting it on, heading out the door. Once I'm on the bike, I forget about it. So perhaps it's like you said, when you slip into that more aerodynamic position, maybe the fit at that point just becomes of no consequence, because I don't think about it at all on a ride.
Yeah, exactly. And certain custom jersey companies, like I know Quare does this, and I'm sure other companies will start doing this as well, but they'll let you, because a lot of race jerseys now have longer sleeves, and club jerseys tend to have shorter sleeves that kind of just go around your shoulder, but not too far down on your bicep. And you can actually, with a lot of jerseys, with custom companies, I know, so like I have my jerseys ordered with +2 centimeters. My Quare jerseys are +2 centimeters on the arm and -2 centimeters in the waist, just to make it a little more race fit for those reasons. But you could also make it a little longer, shorter, whatever you wanted. So it's pretty cool. Things are changing there. You can actually customize that stuff. So Nathan, great job on the podcast and the blog. I'm learning a ton. I'm a 43-year-old mountain biker, and you race XC, which is cross country for those that don't know. The last 3 years, I've done a Freel type heart rate based training plan that usually falls apart in late May. That's what you say there. It was my first year with Trainer Road, though, and I'm on week 6 of the Sweet Spot mid-volume 2 base training plan, and really excited to get into the build phase. One thing I have learned through your podcast is that in the years past, I have spent most of my Zone 2 work actually in Zone 3 and not doing myself any good. So, Chad, what do you say there?
Yeah, let's talk about that real quick, because we're coming back to that whole tempo thing, tempo being useless. And again, it's not useless. It's actually a very productive place to train. There's a lot of aerobic benefit, a lot of good training adaptation that takes place there. The concern is that if you do all your work in Z3, it's not a zone that's hard enough to really influence any big change, and it's not a zone that's easy enough to actually let you recover. So it gets that kind of that gray definition, but that doesn't imply that it's not a useful place to train. In fact, if you're an Ironman triathlete, for instance, that's your race. That's where you're going to be the whole time. So get that out of your head. It's still a productive place to train.
So, and to say it a different way, Chad, is you don't want to do Z3 work, what then makes it so you can't do your VO2 max and threshold workouts, and it takes away from that.
And it also hampers your recovery. So you wouldn't want to use Z3 work, you know, thinking it's Z2, and in your case, you're actually in Z3 and you're wondering why you're not recovering. That's just because it's a little too strenuous. Mm-hmm.
So his question, low-intensity aerobic endurance training sessions seem like they are too much or too low of intensity. So I've been using the workout intensity adjuster in Trainer Road to bump up the target power between 10 and 20%. By the way, my mother is I'm getting her on Trainer Road. She's super fit. She's 60 and has a six-pack. She's insane. She like works out every single day, but she's not like some crazy fitness freak. She just says she does it because it makes her happy. But she does this same thing, and it's so tough, because just like what we talked about, she isn't resting fully, but she feels like she isn't doing enough work in the rest, and then her work intervals suffer as a result, because she isn't giving herself all the time to rest there. So this gets my heart rate and perceived exertion where I feel like I'm doing work. Is this an okay thing, or am I pushing up into the threshold zone and no longer training my aerobic base? Do I just trust the power target and forget about heart rates?
Not necessarily, because if you haven't assessed to your full capabilities, this 10%, 20% bump may actually be necessary to get you more on target. So if you're riding and it's like mind-numbingly boring, you're probably not doing a whole lot for you, unless you're going to do that for 4 or 5 hours straight. So bringing up the intensity a little bit and making it feel like work, but you know, not overly strenuous work, work that you could do, you know, for long stretches, but you know, your breathing's up, your heart rate's up, and you feel like, okay, this is going to have some effect, but it's not wiping you out. That's basically what you're looking for. Where that falls, just because the target power says do it here, that's based on an FTP assessment that, that fairly represents what you can do. Maybe you didn't assess your full capability.
But two, like zone two is not hard, right? So I know
that's true.
I'm in the same plan right now, and there's like a Wednesday and Friday zone two effort. I think Wednesday sometimes has a couple bumps into zone three, but they're like an hour long, and I look forward to those days. It's mm-hmm. like you get off and you feel pretty good. I burned about 600 or 700 calories. You know, it's not a big deal. And
yeah, for sure. That some of these workouts should feel easy. They should feel boringly easy. So with all of what I said, definitely keep in mind what Nate said. Some of those days are easy days. They're supposed to be basically active recovery, just keeping your muscle tissue pliable, keeping the, you know, the blood flowing, helping you basically gain a slight training benefit, perhaps, while you recover.
Actually, I get a lot because it's still that extra TSS bump, and I feel like adding those workouts in are really helping me. And then on Sunday for this plan, there's longer two, I think it goes up to 2.5 hours on the weekend. And those, I mean, it feels easy for the first, it's weird for like, if it's a 2 hour and 15 minutes for the first 2 hours, it's pretty easy. Then for the last 15 minutes, I'm like, okay, I'm feeling a little something here. And the next time, the next last 15 minutes is a little bit of something. But in general though, yeah. Like the Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, which are the interval ones, especially Saturday, Chad, I hate you. Those ones are extremely hard, and those take all my mental energy. And that's where I think too, I'm at the right threshold for me, because as I go through those, like, you know, I am suffering and they are hard workouts. So I agree. If Nathan's doing this and he goes, Friday was a piece of cake, like, which is, I think, the hardest workout of the week. It was easy. You're probably underassessed. If Friday's incredibly hard and you're like, Sunday needs to be hard too, because I am a athlete, then probably just ride with where you're supposed to be.
If the prescribed workout has me doing sweet spot or higher, I've never found myself thinking that this rest interval is too easy if my FTP is accurate.
Yeah, and that's how it should be too. Anything sweet spot or higher, if you get to those recovery valleys and you weren't at least looking forward to them, probably not exactly on track.
Yeah, you should just be wishing those things could continue for a little more every time, and then the next interval starts up. Hopefully that. Good call, Nate, on picking out those TSS filler. That's kind of what we've called them there. Those additional workouts that are less intense. Those do serve a purpose. Always remember that it's not about the amount of stress you can heap on your body. It's about the amount of stress your body can absorb. Right, Chad?
Yeah, exactly.
Those days are fantastic for absorbing stress. It's a really solid deal there. So, did we read the last part of his question there?
No,
we just got Paul.
All right.
Yeah, cool. I think we covered it.
Nice. Paul, I have little experience with structured VO2 max training, and it certainly is a limiter for me. I have been starting to experiment with them and have some questions. First, I want to give kudos to Chad on his January blog post about the science behind VO2 max. That was a killer blog post, by the way, Chad. Good job.
Yep, and due credit. There's a team that puts those together. I contribute the content, and they flesh it out and make it concise and understandable. So yeah, there's a few of us working on that.
Kudos to Chelsea Haney, our marketing director, for writing that one up. She's brilliant. So he says, the relation between VO2 max training and FTP has always been confusing, and his blog, along with some of the recent podcast discussions, has helped. Hopefully that previous question we answered for you did too, Paul. Now for a couple questions. I think you have sort of covered this before, but I want to ask it again. I struggle with a workout like Geiger. Hitting 120% of FTP is one thing, but holding it for 3 minutes is another, particularly with a 1-to-1 recovery period. Assuming accurate FTP, would you expect these to be hard numbers to reach on initial attempts, or would most people have to work up to 120% for the full 3 minutes?
Geiger's not 120%.
Yeah, it's a different workout. So he's got the workout name mixed up, so maybe Mills or Huffaker or something, but the 120% efforts at 3 minutes are stringent, to say the least. There's a lot more to this question, which I definitely want to talk about as we get to it. But initially, let's just get it clear that 120% is what we use because it works for a lot of riders. It's a high percentage, especially if your FTP is accurately assessed. It's a high percentage to hold for 3 minutes at a time. And then to repeat them with, you know, only 3 minutes rest, and some of those recoveries even shrink, makes it an even taller order. So you may find And we'll talk about this as this question opens up, but you may find that the workouts become a lot more productive if you trim off a little bit of that intensity. We're not looking to bury you with one or two intervals. We're looking to amass a lot of time at a high percentage of your power of VO2 max. So we want to push you up to a really high aerobic uptake or a high oxygen uptake, breathing really hard, really stressing the heart and lungs. And we want to keep you there for a long time without burning you up. Maybe 120% burns you up. Maybe 115 doesn't quite. Maybe you find like a happy medium in there, and it's 117 and you can get through these barely. That's more along the lines of what we're searching for. So don't lock yourself to that 120% and think that that's just written in stone, because it certainly isn't.
Two, like when you finish those, like they're really hard, right? Because he kind of writes that when he turns it down, it's more tolerable. Like I find them intolerable. Like, you know, I'm halfway through and I'm like, I cannot do this. But then
totally.
I end up doing
fact,
it.
Go on with this question, because this might be literally my favorite question that's ever been submitted, because it's incredibly astute and really detailed.
He says, I generally dial a workout like these 120% FTP workouts. I dial the intensity down to 95%. So that's just dropping the overall intensity of the workout by 5%, which makes it a bit more tolerable, but I'm concerned about missing the training benefit, the astute observation there. Just FYI, I have race data which shows repeated 90-second efforts at 140%. Usually I crack on one of these efforts and get spit out the back, a very definite area of weakness for me.
Yeah, and if I could just interject, not to pull us off course here, but this is a really good case for using the workout creator, especially as you get close to this event. You know the demands of your event. These are things you want to practice. So maybe 3-minute efforts aren't the best fit for you once you get closer to your event. So actually make this workout. Who are we talking to, Paul? Make this workout, Paul, and practice it. Know that when you get out on the race course, you're going to be able to drill it for 140% and do it more times than you used to, maybe as many times as is necessary to make the final selection.
He says, I'm curious about the actual physiology of a VO2 max interval. I was recently doing some 2-minute intervals at about 110% of FTP. The first couple followed this pattern. First 30 seconds, God, I'm awesome and I'm going to crush this thing. At 60 seconds, that's common for everyone. At 60 seconds, legs starting to burn but still holding power okay. Starting to breathe a little hard. At 90 seconds, definite inflection point in my breathing, starting to pant, wondering what the heck I'm doing this for. 120 seconds in, barely finish, feel like I can't catch my breath, nearly about 30 seconds until it's starting to feel better. The limiter on these intervals feels cardiovascular.
And there is a VO2 max interval encapsulated perfectly in 30-second increments. That's it.
Yep. The subsequent intervals follow a similar pattern. However, my breathing tends to be much more in control, and in reference there is aerobic priming and pathways.
Yeah, so
Chad, go ahead.
We'll get to this. We'll get to it.
Okay, and I never really get that almost out of control panting feeling. What does happen instead at 60 seconds is I still get the burn, but also start to feel muscle weakness. At 90 seconds, there is still an inflection point in the breathing rate, but it feels much more in control and sustainable. I don't really ever get the panting feeling. By 120 seconds, I'm feeling like I can't generate enough pedal force, and again, barely finish. I'm breathing hard, but can quickly get my breath back. My legs feel tired and weak. So what is interesting to me is that given the exact same power output, the first few intervals feel like cardiovascular limitation, while the latter intervals feel more like a muscular endurance issue. I'd be interested in whatever comments you have about the underlying physiology of VO2 max efforts in general and how the different processes come into play over the course of an interval session. Then, so Chad, do you want me to read the next little bit before we go on with this FTP?
No, that's actually not really germane. We can go where we need to go with the information that we have. Two things to discuss here, and the first is the warming process. A lot of the warm-ups are short, so your first couple intervals are particularly demanding, and that's what you're feeling. And you're working through that, and you're getting to those latter intervals that see you fully warm. So there's a fair amount of aerobic priming. You know, you got to open up those aerobic pathways before these workouts start to kind of hit home, which is why even with the short workouts, I'll put efforts that are incremental. You know, maybe you'll start at 110, then 115, and then 120, or maybe even the first couple of intervals are dialed down a little. And if they're not, feel free to do that manually. Actually drop the workout intensity, be a little kinder to yourself over the course of your warm-up, even if it means taking the first couple intervals at slightly reduced rates. And then once you get into them, what we're after here is what's called, in the case of VO2 max work, essential strain. We're trying to really work the heart and the lungs. That's what the VO2 max efforts are after. We're trying for adaptations that take place more at that level than the muscular level. So if you're working at 120% and it ends up being too much, we're overly straining the muscles, and the muscles are petering out before we can inflict the sort of strain that we want on the central system. So that's peripheral fatigue. And not to throw a bunch of coaching terms at you, but you're cooking your muscles before we're getting the stress we want on your heart and lungs. So this is yet another case for trying to find that balance between, you know, what's repeatable, what doesn't completely waste you by the end of the interval and come at the or cause the subsequent intervals to suffer. We want VO2 max workouts to be to reach a high level and stay at that high level, but to remain repeatable, not to completely waste you. By the end of the workout, yeah, you're completely wasted. But if three intervals into an 8-interval workout, you're finding you're bailing out early, you're then turning it down, kind of miss the mark a bit.
Hmm. So what do you think he should do?
Yeah.
I mean, in his case, I think he should try.
One thing really quick, Chad.
Go ahead.
He says that he's 58 and VO2 max has always been a bit of a challenge too. So age is factoring in at that point.
Yeah, for sure. So, and especially in the case of a 58-year-old athlete, 120 may be way too high. So I say give 115 a shot right now. And that sounds like what you're already doing. You said you drop it 95%. That's effectively going to bring it down really close to 115% of your threshold. So I think you're on the right track already. If you were going to do anything else in addition to that, I would just make your warm-up a little more friendly, even if that means getting on the bike and riding for 15 minutes or dialing down the intensity of the warming intervals or the first couple of intervals. Just look at the overall quality of the workout and realize that dialing it down a little bit in the early segments of the workout can have a really profound effect on the rest of the workout.
Cool. Well, hopefully that gives you all the info you need there, Paul. And I think that'll do it. Yeah, that'll do it for this week. Lots of questions, guys. So please keep submitting them. Submit to support@trainerroad.com. We'll have a cool new way for you to submit questions in the near future. Stay tuned for that. Share this podcast when you're listening to it. Let other people know about it. I'm sure we're answering questions, not only your question, but that same question is beholden by a lot of people. We've found that. So give it a share, give it a like, a rate, whatever you wish there. Thanks for listening, guys. We'll talk to you next time.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye-bye.